My guest today on Newton Talks is R.M. Francis, who is a poet and author and lecturer in creative and professional writing at the University of Wolverhampton. And we're going to be talking about his new novella called The Wrenner, which is set on the Wren's Nest estate in Dudley in the Black Country. Now, before we meet Rob, let's listen to an extract from The Wrenner, read by the author himself.
The Lay. It's the Wren's Nest, part housing estate, part nature reserve. It's the Wrenner to us. Frog spawn slicks in silica sheets across green pool. Carrion crow calls. The fox's den too close to the road. Vixens crushed against tarmac. Limestone cliffs weathered by prehistoric waves. The underground caves. The fenced off caverns. The canal lines that vein through. Rabbits, badgers, weasels, and rusted cans and cigarette butts, and fly-tipped sacks and discarded clothes, and the stained knickers of a fallen wench. Limes, acorn, hawthorn, bluebell, and stinky wild garlic. Bell pits, old mine shafts, and geological tools. Dog walkers amble through slippy tributaries of homemade paths. Rope-swinging kids up a height in the oaks. The silence, the almost silence, the rhizomes that pierce through earth's hymen and tangle, conjugate. None of this is metonym. This land is where we live, the Wrenner. Here's where they dug into the earth and pulled out a giant trilobite, the Dudley bug, not a metonym. The streets orbit the woods, not a symbol, literally. Terraces clad in cobblestone and red brick, meander, side stream, feed, branch, in swirls around the pull of the woods. The estate eddies the woods. Grandson lives with his brood three streets down from Nan, who took the cousin's house, who now lives up by our auntie. She's been there for three generations, and the kids will have it after two. And John and Wendy are two doors up from her sister, and their Babs are just through the alley next to our kid who's used to live with her best friend at school, and she's only a stone's throw from her grandson. Every bloodline webs our Wrenner like this. You say don't walk through here at night. You say to be careful, avoid us, but we're here. Like the frog spawn sticking to the film of algae, we are cells sucking at light, stunned in our own kind of beauty.
Rob, thanks very much for agreeing to be my guest. I really appreciate that. The Wrenner is your second novel. Can you tell us a little bit about it and what started the writing process and what inspired you to write it in the first place?
Absolutely, yeah. Well, it's lovely of you to have me on as a guest. I really appreciate your support, James. Thank you.
No problem.
Yeah, so the Wrenner's my second novel. It's out with Wild Press Books. And it's a story of a chap that has come home after serving in the Navy to find his home kind of irrevocably changed, I guess. And one of the kind of key themes of the book is, what do we do with our sense of self, and what do we do with our sense of place when we find our hometowns or estates or whatever in a state of upheaval? And that was the starting point in lots of ways. One of the big inspirations for me as a kind of creative writer is the field of environmental psychology. So I'm really interested in the way that place and landscape affect individuals and community, and the way that all the different kind of weird signs and symbols and apparatus that make up a place sort of imbibe themselves on our identities. And I was really interested in a kind of fragmented sense of self within a fragmented locale. So it's quite a violent book in lots of ways. It looks at kind of working class culture with loving eyes, I think, but also doesn't hide away from its more violent and vulgar aspects as well.
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to come to that and that kind of depiction of working class life. That's a question I want to think about a little bit later. But you know, first off, you know, can you tell me, are you from the Wren's Nest estate? Can you tell us about the Wren's Nest estate and how it's called the Wrenner? We've heard the extract already from the start of the book, which gives this kind of description of the place where you're set in the novel. And or did you choose the Wren's Nest estate and the Wrenner because of the environmental psychology aspect of it? You thought it was it was a place that impacted upon the people and the way that they act.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a little from column A and a little from column B. I didn't grow up on the Wrenner, but while I was writing this, I was living on the Wrenner. So I lived in Wren's Nest for 6 years while I was writing this. And I suppose there's almost a bit of a kind of sense that time stood still in these Black Country estates and these peculiar places. For those that don't know, the Wren's Nest is a housing estate in Dudley, but it's more than that as well. It's a housing estate that wraps itself around a protected nature reserve and a site of geological heritage and wonder, as well as sort of industrial heritage and wonder as well. So all the really big markers of it's sort of a quintessentially Black Country place where you kind of walk through the streets and estates and you'll see sort of bits of litter and discarded cans and burnt out sofas and teen gangs riding their bikes around and whatever. And then within sort of 3 or 4 minutes, you're in this lush, really gorgeous, thick nature reserve that is also where they used to pull limestone and coal out of the ground and is home to these like really fascinating geological relics as well. And so I was really interested in the way that the kind of the natural reclaims the industrial, really interested in the way that the Wrenner is this place where all of those place confluences come together.
I'm interested in this idea of change that you talk about, because on the one sense, the book is clearly about the change and those subtle changes that happen, like not giving anything in the way in terms of what happens in the book. But it's almost like the changes are happening apart from the main character. He's noticing stuff at a distance, like the gangs coming in and things like that,
right.
Which I thought was really interesting. It's this stuff that's happening on the periphery of the story that eventually kind of bleeds into his life. But there's also an element, isn't there, where triggered me anyway, of my memories of growing up in the 80s and the 90s. But this book's set much, much later than that. So I wonder whether it also tells us something about the unchanging nature of life in these communities and the fact that even though things develop and things change and the decades move on, if you've got the same families living in these same estates and in these same streets and in these same areas, then the same kind of patterns and stories are perpetuated.
Would that be correct? That's about right, yeah. And like I said, there is an element of places like the Wren's Nest that time has stood still, and perhaps it is because of the same, you know, generations and generations of the same families live on the same streets as each other. So you get that really tight-knit community and that sense that of protected customs and protected cultures as well, really. Walking around the Wrenner and sort of living there over the last sort of 6 years, I noticed like kids being kids in a sort of traditional sense, and quite a lot of the Wrenner is based on things that me and my brother and my mates did when we were kids growing up, because although I didn't grow up in Dudley, I grew up just down the road in like sort of between Stourbridge and Lye, and so much of our mucking about as kids was in the woods at the back of the houses and on the scrapyard, and you know those in between edge lands between domestic and wild. So it has quite a lot in common with the stuff that I did when I was growing up, and I noticed that kids were doing the same thing, and you get the same sense in sort of Netherton and Salt Wells. There's still kids mucking about and up to no good, and I sort of smile at myself when I see these like sort of seven or eight young lads on their bikes with that mischievous look in their eye. And so many people are kind of disregard these folks as just like yobs or that they're causing trouble. But I see it as a sign of like, at least these people are getting out there and like being slightly rebellious. I see that as a really beautiful thing. So I sort of wanted to capture it.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a kind of lot of movement in the book. And I think what I liked about it, and I think there's the thing that reminded me so much, was this idea, you'd call it like tight-knit communities. And I know you just use that kind of threw that phrase out there. But there's also a lot of kind of conflict that moves down those generations and spreads out, you know, like a web. You know, and I like the fact that in the book, you've got people who know so-and-so's older brother did this or did that, you know, and or so-and-so's younger brother or cousin did this. And, you know, you're aware of somebody's nana's got some kind of status on the estate or in the area. And the conflict moves and passes through these different connections as well. It's not just about tight-knit communities and being friendly and being and welcoming. There's also violence that passes down these lines.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the reasons that the Wren's Nest is a tight-knit community is because people don't really want to go there. Right. So there is this kind of clash and connection between the tight-knitness and the aggression or the menace of it as well. So, yeah, and of course, you know, although these people know each other and know each other really well and they know families of each other and all these stories are kind of webbing together that, you know, many of us have grown up with the same sorts of characters as Burroughs and his big brother Burroughs, who are these sort of bullying type figures on the estate as well.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that, because one thing that strikes me about the book was the, you know, maybe this is a cliche, I don't know, but the kind of the word visceral comes to mind, right? So one thing, right. I'm pretty certain, I haven't talked to you about this, so by all means tell me if I'm wrong, but I think you made a deliberate decision to bring in kind of textures and trigger people, the reader's imagination around things like liquids and touch and remnants. And you mentioned things like syringes and old tampons and discarded clothing. And I put a couple of quotes that I took from it. You know, stomach bile is mentioned, I think, at least once in the book, and blood and bodily fluids and things like that. It's very much about stuff that you can imagine touching and feeling. There's a kind of like abjectness to this.
Yeah, I mean, abject is exactly the right word for it, you know. And as far as theories go that kind of underpin quite a lot of my drives as a writer, Kristeva's abjection, Freud's uncanny, these sorts of things that are bodily, they're sensory things that are both fascinating and repulsive, really drive me. So I quite like sort of vomit and shit and needles and things that are both disgusting and alluring all at the same time too. And I use them to kind of to give that sort of visceral charge, but also to kind of give a kind of in-between confusion in the reader as well, or at least to the characters. And that's what I hope to do.
Yes. Yeah. Sorry to press you on that, Rob. Can you tell us a little, can you expand on that in-between confusion? That sounds like a really interesting idea. If you could elaborate on that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a sense that when you kind of come across vomit or waste or excrement or those residues that you just mentioned, that on one hand you want to kind of keep away from the infestation or the contamination or the contagion around it all. And that's a sort of natural bodily response, a sort of fight or flight response, which is fairly primal, I think. But there's also a sense that you want to kind of look at it and touch it and bring it up to your nose or, you know. And that's something that kind of Freud explores in The Uncanny, that it's both sort of familiar and unfamiliar and also homely and unhomely. And again, it's sort of mirrored by Chris Stever's ideas in her work on abjection, that it's both attractive and repulsive. So we're stuck in this kind of weird liminal psychological state, and indeed a kind of liminal landscape in the book, where we're not sure whether to be harassed and put off by something, or that there's a sort of strange sense of comfort in it as well. You know, I mean, I guess I'm, lots of this come back to my sort of my love of body horror and like old 80s and 90s body horror, like Carpenter and stuff like that, where, you know, as a kid, if I watched The Thing, I knew that there was something sexual happening, even though I couldn't sort of articulate it in my mind. I knew the weird, twisted bodies did something to my stomach. And it's only now that I can kind of realise that it's the coming together of dread and sex and lust and all those sort of primal things that are bubbling to the surface.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think there's a single page in the book that doesn't mention some form of texture or liquid or some form of this discarded abject thing.
Yeah. And I mean, the sensory thing is really important to me, I think. You know, I like the idea that the reader can kind of smell and touch and taste the same things. And it's a writing trick, I suppose, in lots of ways, that if I can give that sensory information to the reader, they're going to place themselves in that world a little bit easier and won't slip out of the story world.
Yeah, I mean, for me, reading it, it often comes as a shock. You know, it's like the way you drop that stuff in. It kind of punctuates what's happening with the characters or the dialogue. That's certainly how it felt to me.
This is the second extract from Rob's novel, The Renner.
Gorse Road. Every now and then I'll get some liver from the butcher. Try that meat, jelly, metal flesh, aspic snap again. I can't figure it out fully. There's something that draws me in. Like how we enjoy our own smells sometimes. Enjoy being fetid. Bernadette Carlin looked after us on dark nights sometimes. There were 7 or 8 of us. Auntie Carlin, that's what the moms made us call her. They'd go up the Spills Meadow for dominoes. The loser would have to look after her on a Sunday. Dad said she was his childminder when they were kids too. We loved it and we hated it at Auntie Carlin's up on Gorse Road. There was so much clutter, too much. One thing bled into the next. There was no start or end of any of it. Novelty teapots pushed into every inch of shelf space. Archives of old magazines. Old Osbrasses tacked to a fireplace. Wall racks of pipes. Corn cob, clay. Meerschaum, framed the hall, stairwell and landing, plates nailed to plaster, marking every royal event, bowls of sticky suck, too much to see, always open-ended.
So you mentioned the sensuality, and that's another thing that I've got down on my notes here, to talking about the sexuality of the book. You've got it between kind of male and female, you've kind of got kind of borderline homosexual incidents and events and comings together, and also the way it's the sex bleeds over into the idea of deviancy as well, with things like voyeurism, and there's an element of voyeurism in the book, in that one of the characters has been done for voyeurism, the crime of voyeurism. So you've got this kind of all these twisted and intersecting sexualities as well. You know, it's to do with crime, it's to do with secrecy, it's to do with lust, as well as it's to do with the bodily function aspect of it.
Yeah, I think so. And again, I think that comes back to that sort of sense of being in between as well. So if you take my kind of opening remarks about Wren's Nest in itself, that it's like a little bit urban and a little bit rural, a little bit wild and a little bit domestic. So you're in this kind of liminal realm, and within that liminal realm, it just opens up the possibilities for sort of transgressive, subversive activity. So that's, yeah, I guess, why it's there.
Yeah, and I think you don't have to have any comment on that. But there was one moment in the book where the young version of the central character, he's remembering Juno, who's like the kind of
yeah,
the hot girl on the estate, and he accidentally licks the frog spawn off his fingers that he forgets there, and he kind of, and it's like it all comes together. It's a really revolting image, right? But at the same time, it's not a revolting thing for that main character, because it's like it triggers a warm memory in him. You know, it instigates a warm kind of memory of her.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
and I think it kind of brings all those things together, which I really like. And you also, you know, mention a lot about let's go back to this idea of the violence as well, because one thing I noticed, you're not just talking about violence happening. There's also several of these characters have got training in violence as well. One of them has gone to the boxing club. There's the some of them have been in the military before. You mentioned the Shaolin monk that the father used to train with. So you've got that kind of training in violence as well. Can you tell us something about that?
Yeah, it's a tricky one, really. I mean, in lots of ways, I'm exploring without trying to cast any aspersions on masculinity and violence. And also the sometimes beautiful poise of a very well-trained assassin type figure as well. So, you know, I mean, I'm into my sport and I like boxing, and I really like martial arts as well. And maybe it's another in between. I'm just riffing here, really. But it's another one of those where, I mean, I studied Kung Fu for quite a few years, and it's both a dance in the sense that it's a really beautiful kind of ballet that you really have to sort of finely tune your body to. And absolutely everything is about precision and using your body as efficiently as you can. But it's also designed to maim and kill. So there's an interesting kind of conflict there as well. And I think maybe there was just some interest and intrigue from my point of view on the sort of pressures, but also the kind of beautiful traditions of men being men, that there's in some ways there's a pressure there, especially in these communities. But there's also a really nice sort of sense of passing down through the generations of these skills as well.
Yeah, I mean, again, I don't mean to put you on the spot with any of this stuff, because I know that when you write, you're not necessarily thinking in terms of these kind of analytical details. So maybe some of it is just what interested me and what stood out for me. But I think it's a nice contrast between the kind of the idea of these, the Rena being a kind of wild place, but also something that needs, that certain men need kind of training in that, and the discipline that provides as well. And there's a different distinction between the kind of, you see, I think, tell me if I'm wrong on this, there's a sense of honour to the characters who are trained in terms of the boxing, in terms of the kung fu, in terms of the military, in terms of the going into the Navy, those characters, and the other characters, the skinheads who turn up, the gangs who turn up, the bullies who turn up. There's definite distinction between those two types. And it's almost as if you're making the claim, which is a fair claim, it's one I completely agree with, about the kind of the honour in kind of training in combat and combat sports and things like that.
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's the difference between a kind of righteous anger and an anger that is being channeled through the skill and through the art versus an unrighteous one that is loose and undisciplined.
Yeah, and there's and then that kind of that if that's a moral choice or a moral decision, that's definitely kind of passed down in terms of the main character who's got a kind of moral sense, or you get an idea of his moral kind of sense of righteousness or what he thinks is right. The book's got a really interesting structure. It's sort of fractured and episodic, and some chapters are 3 or 4 lines long, and some chapters are 4 or 5 pages long. And so it's disjointed and it's fractured and it's episodic. Why did you choose that?
If one of the main themes or characters is landscape and place and the way that that influences people, then one of the others is memory. So much of the story is put down by my main guy's remembering of kind of formative childhood experiences. And it was just to try and add form to the content, really, that it's intended to be a sort of textual version of how memory works in some ways, that we don't always remember all of the details, and sometimes we remember the really peculiar things that no one would even really care about. And sometimes they come in little flashes, and sometimes they come as like big, whole, solid narratives that we can remember in great detail. So that's the sort of reasoning behind it, really.
Yeah, and I like what you said there. I made a note earlier when I was doing my notes for this, is that memories are remnants too, which is you just pretty much just said there. Yeah. So and also I link that to this idea of back down to the kind of syringes and the discarded rubbish and the beer cans and things like that. It's like they're remnants and the memories are remnants, and it's sort of, yeah, they all kind of like, you know, it's the form and the content there come together.
Yeah, yeah. And in the same way that the sort of, if you walk around Dudley or the Black Country or Briley Hill or wherever, the Black Country is full of these cultural memories that are sort of lost as well. I mean, Tom Lee Rutter in your podcast with him mentions his kind of like love of the Black Country landscape and how that there are these little gems that are on the edge of the estates and things that, and these are the places that are kind of constant reminders of what we did really brilliantly during the Industrial Revolution and into the kind of 20th century. But also reminders that all of that's gone now. And so there's that kind of haunting quality about them too. So those are cultural memories that are scattered or in ruins.
Yeah, that's a good word there. Scattered is reflected in the structure of the book and the kind of things that we see in the book as well, the kind of things we read about in the book. One technique that you use is that you intersperse the book with extracts from the Dudley Chronicle.
Yeah.
The newspaper. And these come in and they're kind of, again, it's on the periphery. It's like, it almost as if the plot is happening elsewhere, right? The plot of the book is the periphery, the story of the changing nature of the estate and the violence that's bringing and the kind of disappearance of these girls. But it's happening on the periphery. So we get these pages from the Dudley Chronicle.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's exactly it. You know, it's as if the characters in the book are so preoccupied with their day-to-day stuff that there are things happening and there's a sense that change and upheaval's happening, but they can't quite put their finger on it. And so these little extracts from Dudley Chronicle and the remarks of the off, you know, just disregarded remarks of someone in the pub who says something, are the things that are driving the plot in lots of ways, but are always happening just out of sight or just out of reach.
This is the third extract from the Wrenner.
Spinny. On the cowpaths or main route, your eye might get caught by the chalky yellow of limestone collected into small piles. I'm not sure how well we remember these things. We'd take the steps down into the umber and tan, the stench of wood rot and new stems. We'd cut through the slade, the coo-caw of pigeon and crow, the scuttle snaps of rodent. And around a corner, sometimes, the limestone burial mound that wasn't there a week ago and will soon be gone.
Can you tell us something about your literary and your cinematic influences?
I suppose my go-to guy in most recent years is the late Joel Lane, who was a weird fiction writer and a horror writer, but also a writer of detective fiction and sort of urban noir. And so much of his work is set in the Black Country in Birmingham. And there's a sense in his work that there's some weird kind of Lovecraftian fundamental entity or genius loci or something anyway that is underneath the soils of the region, and it's that kind of brings the horrors out, brings the violence out, and the way that we live our lives somehow whispers the devil up or kind of summons things. So that he's been a really big influence. I absolutely love Joel Lane. And that kind of tapped back into my love of body horror and folk horror. And so although The Wren is not a horror story, and neither is my first novel really, Bella, there are elements of the supernatural and elements of dread and suspense and that kind of off-kilter weirdness in there as well. I guess, I mean, I grew up like really loving and watching Tales of the Crypt and Tales of the Dark Side and Hammer House of Horror and Tales of the Unexpected and things like that. And I remember sort of, they're the kind of things that you'd watch as a kid at like 2 o'clock in the morning when you should be asleep. And every now and then you'd come across a B movie or an episode of Tales of the Crypt that just stuck with you for a few days. And you it didn't terrify you at the time, but there was just some lingering sense of weirdness that stuck with you. And I try and bring that out in my work. So, for example, in The Wrenner, every chapter, every sort of set piece or sequence in the book is named after one of the roads on the Wrenner. And all of the roads on the Wrenner are named after bushes or plants or trees. So I kind of use that as a sort of anchoring device and a symbol of the way in which community and roots kind of come together. But also each little section has got an element of sort of plant folklore about it. And of course, there's then like characters like Olwyn, who you're not quite sure is a real person or a ghost. And there's the Laurel Witch that you're not sure is just a local rumor or is an actual witch. And there are a few other characters. Auntie Carlin is another one who's sort of witch-like in her characteristics. And I wanted to put those there to kind of give that sense, to leave the reader with that weird lingering feeling, but also to kind of to keep the reader guessing as to whether or not these are literal political and social events that are happening, or whether there is something in the place itself that's causing all of the upheaval. Those are two really big influences. But again, I'm really sort of inspired by quite a lot of social realist work as well. So Alan Sillitoe, Hugh McDermott, Tony Harrison, Irvine Welsh, but most importantly, another local writer, Anthony Cartwright. He's a Dudley-based writer. He's written 5 novels now, I think, and a really, really brilliant, gorgeous depictions of working class life in Dudley. And another thing that he manages to do really well is to kind of bring in bits of history and bits of folklore and bits of urban legend into his novels as well. So like one of his most recent ones is a novel called Iron Towns, which is a sort of imagined town on the edge of the Black Country, and it's about people dealing with well, I guess it's about life lived in those locations in lots of ways, but he intersperses the main story with snippets of Anglo-Saxon history, I suppose. And so you can never really be sure whether this kind of history is repeating itself because of political change or social problems or whatnot, or whether there's this sort of haunting quality about it as well. So yeah, I mean, those are the big guns really for me.
Another extract from the Renner.
Mayfield Road. I wander Dudley streets, old canals and factories. All faces are sad now. I take a road I've never been down before. It's rained. The road's slippery. Time is too late. The slippery road takes time to go down. Alone, black tarmac and morning shadows. No one has used these sites where rusted chains mark metal doors, left empty when the change came. Withered parts of machines and machinists beacon the pavements. In the room at the end of the road, a curled finger seduced me inside. A redness comes over me sometimes. On these streets, the ghost stench lingers.
So in terms of this idea of the working class life and the depictions of working class life and things like social realism, this is not a complaint. It's certainly not a complaint to you. But this is what struck me when I've been watching films recently. I came across the Richard Billingham film, Ray and Liz. And I think he was brought up in Cradley Heath, I think. So it's not too far away. And he makes this film, Ray and Liz, and it's about his parents. And I know he's done a lot of photo exhibitions and biographical films about his parents. And this one's kind of semi-fictionalized. And on the one hand, it's accurate and I like watching it. But how do you solve this dilemma of depicting working class life without it coming across like a fucking misery all the time?
Yeah.
Now, on the one hand, it's like I know a few people, colleagues in other universities and people that I know who are very passionate about depicting working class life accurately and are very scathing, understandably, about middle class depictions of working class life that depict us as people living in utter misery and squalor all the time. They have to kind of repeat the same representations. And I don't know how you square that circle.
It's a really interesting one, isn't it? I mean, I can't remember who said this now, but there was a recent quote that, like, around getting working class people to go to the theatre and the kind of literary establishment and kind of drama school types thought, oh, well, we'll just put stuff on about miners. They'll all love that. So, there is that element to it. It's a tricky one, isn't it? And I think it's about perception. I think it's about the way in which the writer or the filmmaker invite their audience in. But it's a very, very thin line between kind of poverty porn or kind of working class safari and actually being a genuine depiction of something. You know, I mean, I did an event last year with the writer Lisa Blower, and we got asked a similar question. You know, isn't there a worry that what you guys are doing is just kind of giving a kind of goldfish bowl for everybody to gawp at? And she came up with a really interesting answer that kind of, she used George Orwell as an example, and how George Orwell, in his writings and depictions of working class life, there's always a sense that he's moving through the place and has a kind of tourist and a tourist and journalist distance from him and the subject. Whereas I think somebody like Richard Billingham and somebody like Anthony Cartwright or Liz Berry invite their readers and viewers into something that's well known to them. And I don't know how they do that, but there is a sense you know, and it's more than just authenticity. Because, you know, I mean, Ken Loach's films are fairly authentic. But the sentimentality of Ken Loach's films perhaps give that sort of distance. But you don't get that with Ray and Liz. There's no sentimentality there. And it's the same with Shane Meadows' work as well, isn't it? You know, there's a love and hate in equal measure. And there's a... You know, there's a sense that the filmmaker and the writer know that place intimately that you don't get in other works.
I suppose for me, I mean, I think you're absolutely correct there. I think for me, it's always about, and some of the work that I've done is about telling the real and the genuine from the fake and the kind of tourist is just a matter of kind of perception. And it's often it comes often down to biographical analysis and what you know about the filmmaker or the writer.
Sometimes it certainly does with Billingham, because I think the build up to the feature film is as important as the film itself. Knowing about his journey as an artist and a young lad growing up, and the way that he's documented it over decades, really. Is a really important factor in our viewing.
Yeah, and I think with something like Richard Billingham, you mentioned the phrase poverty porn, and he's got a sense of that and how to avoid that, because he casts White D from that program. What was it, Benefit Street? She plays an older version of his mother at one point. So he's clearly making some comments on that by casting her in that role. So yeah, the film absolutely avoids it, and absolutely, it's not a charge that I'm putting at your work either. It was just something that really stuck out to me, and kind of how to handle those paradoxes and contradictions.
Yeah. I mean, it's a really tricky one, and it's something that plays on my mind quite a lot because another one of my really big influences is Tony Harrison, the poet from Leeds. And so much of his work is about him trying to reconcile his working class heritage and roots with his now, I am a poet and well-established member of the literati. So much of his work is about that. And I sort of feel similar, really, that, you know, when I was growing up, it was definitely a working class culture that we lived in. But then my dad did really well for himself and my family did really well for themselves. So we kind of like became, I don't know, something else, really. And there's a sense that like all of my mates, I still go and play pool and still go to the local snooker club and I still like drink shots with my mates in Netherton and whatever. And really love working class culture in that sense, like football and sport and fishing and hanging out with your mates and all of those things. But I'm also Dr. Rob Francis from the University of Wolverhampton, who's written several books, you know. So there's that conflict in me as well, that I don't want to be the guy that goes, I am an authentic version of the working classes, because I'm not really, and I don't think there really is one. No, I don't think there is one.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a really good answer. I think that is a really good answer. And maybe the question that I pose is a false one in some respect. You know, it was just in terms of the issue of representation for all sorts of different groups is a hot topic.
Yeah, it really is. And it's like it's a big thing in kind of literature at the moment as well, you know. People like Kit Duvall and the Common People anthology. There's recently been 32, which is the kind of Irish equivalent of Common People, which is a kind of anthology of working class life writing. And those teams have done a lot to kind of reshape the argument and reshape the discussion around working class literature and who's allowed to speak and and just offering a bit more of a nuanced discussion on what working class is and isn't. And but it's a fraught discussion, isn't it? It's a fraught discussion because there's an element that I always think the kind of cultural gatekeepers are saying to the working classes, listen, if you guys read more, you'll be just like us and won't that all be better. But you never really hear of like community groups taking problematic public school boys to learn boxing or how to throw arrows at a board.
I've got someone I know who I've met a couple of times and I know through social media, a filmmaker called Deirdre O'Neill, and she's an academic as well. And she's got a good response to this when people talk about this idea of you're not working class anymore because you work at a university. And she says, well, if that's the case, that implies that working class people aren't welcome at university.
Yeah.
There can never be a working class person ever in university or ever work at a university if they become de facto middle class just by having the lecturer.
We get sucked into the big blob that is.
Yeah. And so, like, you know, a working class person could never be a well-known poet or an established author, you know, if that is the thing that disqualifies you from being working class. What responses have you had to the book?
People are enjoying the poetry of the novel, I think. I think people are enjoying the sort of spirit of place that gets conjured. Well, like you've picked up as well, I think people are weirdly enjoying that sensory, visceral quality about it as well. So that's the kind of feedback I'm getting so far anyway, and I'm very happy that I'm getting that.
What else are you working on?
A couple of things. So for the last 12 months, and it will be ongoing until December now, I'm the poet in residence for the Black Country Geological Society. So I've been working on a series of poems that, again, play with this idea of place identity and the ways in which place and people come together and connect and clash, but with more of a focus on the geological and more of a focus on the underpinning of the lay of the land and the makeup of the land. And this kind of coincidentally really came in at the same time that the Black Country Geopark got UNESCO heritage, UNESCO status as a global geopark. So I'm working on a series of poems that look at, so for example, I mean, on simple terms, you know, the industry gave rise to cultures and communities that sort of lived together and worked together and worshipped together and played together. So Round Oak Steelworks sat in the middle of lots of different housing estates that were full of religious buildings and recreation grounds and working men's clubs and things like that. So that was the sort of linchpin, the epicenter of kind of culture and community. But underneath that, you've got the fossil rich and limestone rich grounds and coal, that none of that would have happened had it not been for that. So I'm taking a sort of deep time perspective on Black Country nuts, I suppose. So that's one thing I'm kind of working on. And I'm currently about 25,000 words into my next novel, which is going to be much more out-and-out horror.
Rob, that sounds great, and we look forward to that. And maybe when that's written and that's out, you can come back again and we'll talk about that book.
Absolutely, I'd love to.
Right, thank you very much, Rob, that was great.
Thanks, James, appreciate your time.
Thanks very much to R.M. Francis for joining me today. The Renner is available from Wild Press Books, and I've left a link in the description. Thanks to you for listening. Newton Talks will return.